Co-Chair Wilken, Senator Stampin, Senator Dyson, Senator Hoffman, myself, Senator Green. Here we have several bills on the schedule this morning, and Senator Wilken, do you have any announcements or anything you'd like to call to the attention for the good of the order?
Thank you, ma'am. Today at 12:30, the Conference Committee on the Operating Budget will meet. The purpose of the meeting will be to organize our efforts, and then tomorrow we will start marching down through the operating budget to start to close out the agencies as we can.
Okay.
And of course, we'll post the schedule by 4 o'clock each day. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And another good budget come to a close. Question on agenda, House Bill 76.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Henry Webb, staff to Representative Samuels. I'm sorry my boss is not able to make it to the meeting this morning. He has another appointment.
Okay, Henry, pull the mic right up, please. Thank you.
House Bill 76 reestablishes the Big Game Commercial Services Board within the Division of Occupational Licensing. The board would oversee the professional hunting and transporting industry. The former board was allowed to sunset, and the duties of the board were transferred to the Division of Occupational Licensing in the mid-90s. Many of the board's powers were transferred to the division. There was an audit done in 2003, and a letter from the Board of Game in 2003 as well, that gave some examples of problems facing the industry. The audit suggested that the legislature consider re-implementing the board of the Big Game Commercial Services Board. Last year, this legislation was carried by Representative Samuels as chair of the LB&A committee, and it passed the Senate in a couple of different forms before running out of time in committee in the other body. This is a big bill. It's 29 pages, but most of those 29 pages are transferring the authority from the division to the board. It takes a lot of paper. The sponsor feels that this bill has received extensive work and that it balances the many concerns of the industry, the public, and those of the concerned agencies that manage the resource. I'd like to go over some of the changes that this legislation has gone through since it passed this committee last year, or the idea. Changes between the current bill and what passed the Senate last year. It's Section 3. We changed the membership of the board from two guides, two transporters, one public, or one member appointed by the Board of Game, and one private owner holder, to two guides, two transporters, one member appointed by the board, two private owner holders, and two public members. So the board goes up to 9.
Mm-hmm. Last year it was 7?
No, you're right, 7.
Okay.
Sorry.
Last year it was 7.
In Section 4, we specified that the board will be required to issue licenses to those who have satisfied the requirements. And then in Section 6 of the bill, originally there was a $1,000 fine in the previous 12 months would preclude someone from receiving or renewing a guide or transporter license. One of the changes is we upped that from $1,000 to $2,000. And then there's a CS that we've, that might be.
Okay, so we need to adopt version Y?
Yes, I believe so. I would like to speak to version Y.
Okay. Senator Wilken, would you move version Y for purposes of discussion, please?
Chair, move the Senate may substitute for House Bill 76, version Y, Unum Rule 421, be adopted as our working document.
What changes in this CS? There were three changes that were suggested by OCC licensing. The first, in Section 4, would remove the requirement that the board award a license at the next meeting, and this is for the sake of flexibility for both the board and the department to award licenses so that it wouldn't have to happen at a meeting of the board.
So you dropped the language at the first meeting of the board?
Yes, we dropped that.
On line, which would now be line 6.
Yes, I believe so.
And then it just reads, and transport a license after the applicant for the license satisfies the requirements of the license. Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
In Section 2, Section 6, we specify that for the suspension of a license, what will be counted is the unsuspended portion of the fine. There was some question there. And that was in consultation with public safety. They recommended that we go with the unsuspended portion.
Okay. And then was the 2,000, 3,000, and 5,000, is that new language?
That was in the bill. That was in the previous version of the bill.
Main thing is the unsuspended fine.
Yes.
Language. Okay. Thank you.
And then in Section 17, we specify some of the criteria that must be included in the guide and transporter contracts. These are not exclusive.
On line 30? And then go to the next page?
Lines 6 through 19 on page 12 is the general area we talk about.
Okay.
And these are not exclusive. The board may come up with more criteria as they deem appropriate, but it's a starting point. The division thought that these were some basic things that should be in the contracts. And with that, I'd try to answer any questions I could.
I do recall that last year we had several hours of discussions and questioning, and in otherwise, language is what we discussed previously.
Correct.
Are there questions from members at the table? Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to note for the record that my guess is that this bill will change slightly my business, and so it'll apply to me. I think it'll
make
my life
more. Would you like to abstain from voting?
Pardon?
Would you like to abstain from voting?
Yeah.
I'll object.
So, me too. But I'm probably going to vote for it. I think it'll make my life a little more miserable.
Well, you have an unconflict of interest. Okay. Thank you. Is there anyone else who has any questions or comments on the legislation? Okay, we have several people signed up to testify, and I want to confirm here in the room. Matt Robus, you're for questions only, or did you have any testimony? Pat Davidson, with questions only. And Lieutenant Todd Sharp, questions only.
Thank you.
Thank you. And on off-net, we have some people who do wish to testify. From the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, Copper Center, Bobby Fithian, are you online?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go right ahead. If you'd give your name and who you represent, please.
This is Bobby Fithian. I live in Lower Tontina, Alaska, and I'm representing the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. Just very minimal comments that this bill is supported by every state or federal or private entity that has any stewardship of our wildlife and wildland resources, that it's about giving proper stewardship, accountability, and sustainability to one of Alaska's oldest and most recognized industries. And really, I don't have anything more. This thing's been hashed around for a long period of time, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have. I really appreciate you taking it up today. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Bobby Fithian of the Alaska Professional Hunters Association? Thank you. Okay, and also Rick Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rick Thompson. I'm a resource manager with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources, and I'm simply here to let you know we support this bill and answer any questions that you may have for me.
Thank you. Any questions for DNR, Rick Thompson? Thank you. And this from the Alaska Professional Hunter, Joe Clutch. Did you wish to testify, or are you for to answer questions only?
No, ma'am. Only to answer questions if there are any.
Okay, thank you. Does anyone have any questions for Joe Clutch? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify that might not have signed up? Thank you very much. We do have a new CS before us. Are there any amendments? Waiting of course. No? No? Is there any interest in any further discussion? Anyone have questions? Gentlemen, you're fine with this? Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 76 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
There being no objection, Senate House Bill 676 moves from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. At ease for just a moment, please. HB 102, and when go to Senate Bill 113 as soon as we finish this.
Thank
Welcome,
you.
Welcome, Ben.
For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. I apologize for the representative not being here, but he had family matters he had to attend to back at home.
Thank you.
Currently, there is a seen shortage of doctors in Alaska as far as doctors per capita. Especially in some specialty fields, you can only count a handful of doctors in the state. In order to curb the shortage, it's important to recognize foreign medical school graduates. Right now, the only requirement for these graduates is to have finished a residency program here in the U.S. What House Bill 102 will do is, at the discretion of the Alaska State Medical Board, is to establish requirements for proof of competency and professional qualifications to allow these graduates to practice medicine in Alaska. If there's any questions.
Are there any questions of the sponsor? But, I think the they have provided a one-page, you know, kind of explanation of it with a form letter from the Alaska State Medical Association. So if there's any more information we need from a sponsor, we can get it. We do have some people who call in to testify as well and who are in the room. And so any questions of Ben? Senator Olson, did you have any?
Actually, I'm very much in favor of this bill. When I was on the medical board as a physician, especially from rural Alaska, we were continually having to run into the snag, and it was an oversight, I think, by previous legislature to not include that. And obviously, we've seen foreign medical graduates that were very good candidates that were unable to go ahead and practice up here in Alaska and went elsewhere because of that. So I'm strongly in favor of this bill, Madam Chair.
Appreciate that insight. Thank you, Dr. Olson. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Morning, Ben.
Morning.
Hey, Ben, just as a point of reference, how is Alaska compare with other states? Do other states do what we're being asked to do here?
For the Chair, Senator Wilkin, I couldn't give you a definite answer, but there is Mr. Jordan in the audience that could answer that question for you definitely.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
And he is on our list of people to testify, so we'll hear from Jim Jordan.
Thank you.
Any other information, any other questions of Ben? On the off-net is George Stewart. George, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Is this the George Stewart I've known for many years?
I believe so, Madam Chairman.
I believe
yes,
it is.
Here in Anchorage.
Yes, did we go back to Lions Club in our other life?
Yes, that is indeed true, at least in the prior part of this life.
Yes, that's right, in our other life, yes.
Right.
Okay, George, go ahead with your testimony on
House Bill 102. Yes, I think, good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this time. I think many of you know I've been practicing here in Anchorage since 1971, which makes me an elder citizen. We have a shortage in my area of specialty, which is pulmonary and critical care medicine. Demographics say we should have 10. Right now we have 8, and two of us are 68 years old and aren't going to practice forever. This legislation is not designed to dumb down acceptance for medical licensure in the state of Alaska. We're not trying to open the door for diploma mills in the Caribbean or something like that. I'll give you two real-world examples. Well, one hypothetical and one real-world example is Senator Olson mentioned is a gentleman named Wilmer Perez, who is a superb physician. He's from Venezuela originally, was fully trained there, and was attending in the critical care unit at Caracas Hospital before he decided to move to the United States. Did a 3-month fellowship at Ann Arbor in the burn unit, did a 2-year fellowship in adult and pulmonary medicine at the University of Texas, has board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary disease, and critical care medicine, is clinical professor of medicine at the University of Colorado, and so he teaches medical students and PAs and nurses all about critical care medicine. Desperately wanted to come to Alaska, but did not qualify for an Alaska license because he had only 27 months of training in the United States instead of 36. Under this legislation, the medical board would have been privileged to review his qualifications and allow him a license, which they very much wanted to do at a hearing last July up in Fairbanks, but they were banned because of the present interpretation requiring 36 months training in the United States, which, in response to a question raised earlier, is more than a number of other states which only require 24. The other example is a physician named Derek Angus. Derek is from Edinburgh, Scotland, did all of his postgraduate training in the Brompton in London. Brompton Hospital was the most one of the most renowned pulmonary hospitals in the universe. Came to the United States on a research fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh, decided he liked Pittsburgh, wanted to stay there, stayed on, is now the chairman of the Department of Pulmonary and Critical Care Medicine, head of the intensive care unit, head of the Division of Healthcare Policy at the University of Pittsburgh, but he would not qualify for an Alaska license because he said no training in the United States. Again, this bill, this change in the wording would allow the state medical board to look at the qualifications of an applicant and determine that they were in fact qualified to take care of Alaskans, and we desperately need this kind of these kind of physicians here. So I am obviously very much strongly in favor of this legislation. Are there any questions?
Yeah, are there any questions for Dr. Stewart? George, it's good to hear from you again. We appreciate your testimony, and we do have your letter, and I'll commit it to the members to read because it has some pretty good, like you said, your anecdotal history there is good.
All right,
certainly
thank you.
Brings the point forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Jim Jordan. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, my name is Jim Jordan. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska State Medical Association. And we have previously provided written testimony to you all regarding this issue, and we urge you to support 102, which will give the State Medical Board the needed flexibility that we feel that they need in particularly dealing with foreign medical graduates. I would also just like to add to that testimony in indicating that it's been recently reported, I think the latest report that I've seen in the popular press was March 3rd in USA Today, that is talking about the shortage of the physicians, or physician population nationally. By the year 2020, in the United States, we're expected to be between 85 and 200,000 physicians short. So we need to have the ability to attract quality, well-trained physicians that may not be trained in the United States. So it's primarily because of this that we strongly urge that you support 102. One other thing, it's a very unusual situation when you have unintended consequences that may be positive. But we feel that in this particular case, we may have some very positive unintended consequences. In Anchorage, it's been reported, for example, that there are 80 different languages that are spoken in the school district. We believe that's reflective of the diverse ethnicity of our population. It is very critical in medical care that the care that is provided be culturally competent. And we feel that there's an opportunity for some foreign nationals who may bring the ability to culturally competently treat patients of the same ethnicity. And it's not only the patients that they treat, but they also serve as teachers for the other physicians in the community. So I think that there's also a very positive unintended consequence of this legislation. So with that, I will stop and ask if there are any questions that I may answer.
Are there any questions of Dr. Jordan?
Excuse me.
You're Mr. Jordan.
Yes.
I was just looking at Dr. Paul Rorell's signature. I'm sorry. Senator Wilkin, you had a question about other states, I believe.
Well, Jim, did you hear the question about where do we compare with other states if we do this?
Yes, I don't have the exact numbers here, but I know that there are other states that require fewer years of graduate medical education. However, it's also my understanding that other states do provide the state medical board with the latitude to adopt by regulation different standards that will provide for, you know, the competency of physicians that are trained outside the United States. You know, what several criteria come to my mind as to what the state medical board may think about. For example, licensure in another state for a period of time so that there's a track record. Obviously, English competency would help a great deal, and I would expect that that would be required. Also, perhaps the person could be recognized as being competent by their being accorded a specialty certification by the American Board of Specialties. Or another is that currently all U.S. medical graduates need to pass a core clinical competency exam, and that may be another item. So I think that, you know, the key is to provide the discretion to the state medical board to adopt by regulation those standards that will make sure that we have competent physicians.
Thank you. Thanks, Jim.
Are there other questions for Jim Jordan? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If this is such a good bill, what took it so long to come to light, and why hasn't it been there before?
Well, I think that the one thing that's helped a great deal is, and you heard testimony from, is Dr. George Stewart, who's come forward with, you know, specific hardcore examples where he's had a real life situation of trying to recruit a physician to replace him, or at least augment him in his final years of practice.
Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim, for being here. We appreciate it. Rick Urien. Morning, Rick.
Morning, Madam Chairman. thank you for the record. My name is Rick Urien. I'm the Director of the Division of Occupational Licensing, and I'm here today to testify very briefly, strongly in favor of the bill before you. You've heard the real-life scenarios from Dr. Stewart, and you heard the support of Senator Olson, that I think their words have been much, much better than mine, but a little discretion in our licensing laws, we can solve a lot of problems, and this is a good step in the right direction. And Senator Olson, I'd like to tell you that I have lots of little fixes for other licensing laws that I've been before you, that it's hard to get people to introduce those things, but this is a good fix, and I hope that you'll support it.
Did you have some repealers in mind as well? Okay, any questions for Director Urien? Thank you, Rick, for being here. Okay. Okay, thank you. Is anyone else in the room who wish to testify on House Bill 102? That's here. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, move to report House Bill 102 from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I just make a comment?
Is it too late?
Oh, no. Okay. Well, I'll just make the comment that I would have gladly sponsored this bill earlier on, but I was too busy trying to protect the NPRA funds.
Is that right? Okay. Well, you should have worked harder.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You should have worked harder on that one, Senator Olson. You missed the mark. Senator Ben Stevens, if you would come join us, please, on Senate Bill 113. Did you have anyone else at the table with you, or are you solo today?
I'll just present it, and then
okay, thank you.
I believe there's some people that are lined up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Ben Stevens, representing Senate District N from Anchorage. Senate Bill 113 is a process piece of legislation that gives the authority to the Board of Fish and the Department of, Commercial Fisheries Limited Entry Commission to develop a new fisheries management regime called the Direct Access Privilege Program. Madam Chairman, I might point out that if you look on the first page of the committee substitute and the sponsor, this is sponsored by me by request of the managers. This is the manager's effort to try to develop a new program for the development of groundfish fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska.
Okay, Senator Stevens, for those of us who don't understand what the managers means, who would that be?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chairman. The managers would be a combination of the Department of Fish and Game, the Board of Fisheries, the Commercial Fisheries Limited Entry Commission, and as well as working with the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council.
Okay, thank you.
This plan, this legislation is a result of about a two-year process with what was called the Gulf of Alaska Groundfish Rationalization Management Team, I believe, which was a combination of those four entities as they try to find ways to keep in alignment with the fisheries management plans that are being developed and implemented in the federal fisheries outside of our three-mile limit. The bill gives the authority to the Department of Fish and Game and the Commercial Fisheries Limited Entry Commission to explore and develop a plan to essentially limit access privileges in the zone that the Alaska manages inside 3 miles to harvest the fish. If you might see in your packet, Madam Chairman, there's what's called a memorandum of understanding in between the Board of Fisheries and the Commercial Fisheries Limited Entry Commission, and that lays out the process from which those two departments will conduct public hearings and the ways in which they evaluate the criteria for participation in this direct access privilege program. It goes without saying, Madam Chairman, anything that has to do with management of commercial fisheries is controversial, and this is a very controversial piece of legislation. If I might just expand a little bit on that, Madam Chairman, and I think the one reason with the highest level of controversy is because it allows the managers to explore development of a new system. And whenever there's the concept of a new system, people become leery, people become afraid, and people don't want the existing system to change. And it's because of those three reasons, I believe, that the controversy and the passion and the objections to moving forward with this plan are so outspoken. I might add, on a personal note, Madam Chairman, that I've been the subject of many criticisms from the implementation of fisheries management plans at the federal level in association with the impact and the influence my father has on those plans. And those same people that are criticizing the federal management plan are again criticizing me at this level of implementation. And it's kind of a sad fact, Madam Chairman, that the criticism can't be targeted towards the plan or towards the implementation or the development of a plan, but it has to be targeted at the individual. So that's just sort of part of the ballpark we're in right now. But this is, as I said, a process that will explore new ways to manage fisheries into the future under rationalization in attempts to continue to maintain the biomass, protect the biomass, to increase efficiencies in the fishery, as well as protect the participants, historical participants, and as well as finding a way for new entry into the fishery, but keeping the economic viability of the fisheries. I believe we have people to testify both in favor of it, against it, and as well as the position of the managers that brought this position forward. So with that, Madam Chairman, if there's any questions, I'm available. Thank you for listening.
For someone who has very little knowledge about this at all, can, in the simplest, clearest way, tell me what this is attempting to do and who thinks that's a good idea, or why someone would think that's a good idea and why someone think that is a bad idea?
In the simplest way I can try to explain it, Madam Chairman, if you look outside of our coastal waters, there's essentially a boundary, and that's a 3-mile boundary. So there's fishing that occurs inside 3 miles and fishing that occurs outside 3 miles. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council manages how those fisheries are conducted outside of 3 miles. The Department of Fish and Game and the Commercial Fisheries Limited Entry Commission manage how the fisheries are conducted inside 3 miles. Outside 3 miles, there's in play an effort, and actually it's going to probably be implemented this year, what's called a rationalization of the fishery outside 3 miles. This bill allows for the inside 3 miles managers to develop a plan to react to what's going on outside. And the ultimate goal, Madam Chairman, of this bill is to protect the state water fishermen from the outside 3 miles fishermen. There's a boundary there. And right now, if it was an invisible barrier, the fishermen from inside can't go outside, but there's nothing to prevent the outside fishermen from coming inside. That's about as simple as terms as I can get, Madam Chairman.
Would this be a pretty good example of any change is worse and more difficult than leaving it the status quo, regardless of what the status quo is?
Well, we heard lots of testimony about that, Madam Chairman. The question is status quo going to make us better off,
right,
or worse off? It's my opinion, and it's the opinion of the managers, that if we stay status quo and the federal managers do evolve into the change that they're developing, we'll be worse off. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what will happen if we don't implement some change?
Yeah. Because the change would all be occurring outside the 3-mile limit. Inside would stay static and not be prepared to react
to those changes
in the outer 3 miles.
And the fear is, Madam Chairman, that there'll be an invasion or an influx of those outside fishermen coming in, harvesting the fish inside, and then going out to the outside.
This sort of neutralizes.
It's an attempt to do that, yes.
Are there other questions, or Senator Stedman?
Yes, Madam Chair, maybe you could have the presenter comment a little bit about the public process and if this is the end or just basically the beginning.
Okay.
to precede public comment period and information of this concept.
Senator Stevens, can you respond to that?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I wouldn't classify this as the beginning or the end. This is a step in the evolution of it. This started, as I said, Madam Chairman, about 3 years ago with the assembly of the Gulf of Alaska Groundfish Rationalization Management Team. And they held Chairman Dersham of the Board of Fish at that time. I believe he said he held 9 public sessions over the course of an 18-month period, and that evolved into the introduction of the development of this legislation. This bill was introduced. Actually, the first time we went through this, if you might recall, Madam Chairman, was an attempt last year that we had a piece of legislation that was a little bit different than this, and that it ran out of time in the last legislative session. Mm-hmm. And then, so this bill evolved. We introduced this bill about mid-February. Senator Wagner and Resources had extensive public hearing on it. It will continue through the legislative process, but most importantly, the memorandum of understanding that's in the packet between the mm-hmm. Board of Fish and the CFEC, there outlines the public hearing process that will be before they develop the direct access privilege criteria. So I would say that in a step 1 through 10, this is probably about number 1.5 or 2.
Okay.
But there's a long process in front of us.
Okay. Does that answer your question? Well, in the course of today's hearing, are we going to hear examples of who opposes this and why?
Yes.
They oppose it? Okay, good. Just want to be sure. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this legislation only deals with the Gulf of Alaska, nothing to do with the Bering Sea.
That's correct. It's only the Gulf of Alaska groundfish fisheries. And thank you, Mr. Hoffman, for pointing that out. It might add, you have to, the underlying piece of this legislation is it allows the Board of Fish and the CFEC to develop a plan, but only at the request of the participants in that fishery. So it does not develop a plan and then impose it mm-hmm. on the fishery. It allows them to say, if the members of that fishery come forward with a proposal or request to be included, then they would go out and impose the criteria and develop the criteria and the plan for the direct access privilege. It gives them the ability to develop a plan at the request of the participants. I think that's probably the most misunderstood piece of this legislation, Madam Chairman, is that it does not impose it on any fishery. Mm-hmm. It allows the managers to develop a plan if the people in that fishery make a request to say that's a plan management plan we want to have as an option for our fishery.
If I might continue on page 2, line 14, you're talking about exclusive harvest shares to persons, and then on line 21, you're talking about access limitations for the dedicated access privilege program. And I'm wondering, once this is set up, how does an individual get into the business? And are these privileges revocable, or are they limited? Or how, you know, I'm concerned, I guess, how do we achieve new access for this process, because if it's successful, you know, I think that this may expand to the Bering Sea.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hoffman, I heard the first piece. What was the second piece that you referred to?
Well, primarily, the second piece was on line 21, the access limitation program on line 21 and 22.
Yeah,
the heart of the whole,
thank
this
you.
Whole that, piece of legislation.
Well, thank you. I might take issue with that the section 1 is legislative findings and intent.
Right. And it talks about that. And
then the actual heart and soul of the legislation is actually found on page 3, section, paragraph C.
I understand that. I referred to, when I said the heart and soul, the whole concept of the dedicated access privilege program is the heart of the, and I'm wondering, how do you envision new access to this program from people that are growing up in Alaska that want to make a livelihood in this industry?
But is your question that it extends to the Bering?
No, it doesn't. It may, if this is successful, it may expand to the Bering Sea.
Okay, because the language here is pretty clear. It's Gulf of Alaska. Okay.
Well, Senator Hoffman brings up a very valid concern, and it can be addressed by the fact that this is not implemented in every fishery. You know, people growing up don't begin by going into the large offshore or heavy trawl fisheries. The fisheries that have been excluded, let me step back. The only fisheries that are going to be included are those that are being requested, and the only fisheries that are going to be requested are those that are under extensive competition and pressure from the gear types. And you know, entry-level fisheries are typically there available now, and they will continue to be there available even if this plan is implemented, or when this plan is implemented, because this plan is going to be implemented specifically for the Gulf of Alaska pollock trawl fishery, as well as, I believe, there's some requests in the rockfish fishery for the trawl fisheries, and maybe some flatfish fisheries, but there already are heavy competition, capital intensive, and they're not typically entry-level fisheries. Matter of fact, we excluded probably the largest entry-level fishery in the Gulf of Alaska, and that's the mechanical jig fishery. We excluded it but it doesn't exclude it forever. If the jig fishermen want to, at some point in the future, say we want a direct access privilege program, they can come back and we can then allow them to be in it. But that's probably the most controversial gear type that's opposed to this legislation, are the entry-level fisheries. And so, the position of the managers and the position I take personally is if those people that participate in fisheries across the state and in the Gulf of Alaska want to have the fisheries managers explore new ways to manage their fish to make it more economic, safer, higher value products, then we ought to give them the right to explore the development of a new management regime. If they don't want it, then they don't have to have it imposed on their fishery. As one of the harvesters from Homer said, this is a tool that we're allowing the managers to create and then implement once the participants agree to it through the public process that's set out under the Memorandum of Understanding.
Senator Hoffman, does that answer
your
concerns?
Yes, it does. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there other questions of the sponsor? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Stevens, remember the senator from Fairbanks who thinks a ground fish is a grayling laying on the banks of the Chena River. Help me through this. So we have the Gulf of Alaska, and within 3 miles of the shore, there's a zone, and it's managed by the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission
and the Board of Fisheries. Yeah,
and the Board of Fisheries.
Well, in AF&G. Yeah.
Okay. And then outside that is a large area managed by the North Pacific Fisheries Council.
That's correct.
Okay. And so the dedicated access privileges apply to which of those zones?
Inside.
So the privilege is held by whom?
By participants that have the scenario that they've done. You can be a participant in both, okay, if you have the history.
Okay.
Or you can be a participant in the federal side only or in the state side only. And right now, you have to understand that the fish swimming around don't understand the differences that we are talking about. The whole biomass is managed and under agreement with Fish and Game and with the council, they allow certain amounts of fish to be caught on both sides. And so we're talking about the amount of fish that's going to be harvested inside.
Okay. And this privilege is granted by the group that's within the three-mile limit?
It's granted to the group inside the three-mile. That's correct.
Granted to the group? To the fishery?
To the fishery. Yeah, that's correct.
And granted by the Alaska Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission?
That's correct.
They grant it. Okay. Yeah. So if I'm out fishing in the outside the three-mile, I could apply for a dedicated access privilege to come in to the three-mile and fish there?
Is that what
this is about?
That's correct. That if they meet the qualifications that they develop in the future by the process that we're giving them. Okay. And that's sort of outlined on page 4.
Okay, I understand. So this legislation is a way to track or to manage those that are outside that want to come into the three-mile.
That's correct, and manage the ones inside to protect them from the outside.
Okay, I understand. Okay. Does the follow-up on what Senator Hoffman talked about, does the dedicated access privilege have value? Is it something you would sell? Is it an asset that appreciates or depreciates?
That's one of the big challenges in this program, because we know that under the Constitution we cannot allocate the resource. And so this is the right to harvest the resource, and it's a privilege, not a perpetuity.
Okay.
And so part of the criteria that they'll develop is how often will it become renewed, how will it transfer, will it go back into a pool to be redistributed to future participants. That's one of the things that the Board of Fisheries and the Commercial Fisheries Limited Entry Commission are given the authority to develop that plan. And I think that goes down to the root of really the opposition is that we're saying we're giving them the right to develop a plan, but we don't know what the outcome of the plan is.
Okay.
But how do we understand the outcome of the plan until we give them the authority to develop the plan?
Does the dedicated access privilege, is it awarded to a fishery in toto, or is it to go to a boat level?
It would go, the way it's developed right now, it would not exclude anybody, although it doesn't give the rights to develop it. So for instance, it doesn't give the right to develop to give that right to a processor, or it does to say anybody who's got historical participation would be eligible for consideration. The way that they've done it in the federal side is they've taken years of participation and your percentages of that you've caught of that quota during those years. That's the percentage you'll get into the future.
Okay.
But we face different challenges because we can't allocate that right. So it's a privilege to go participate in that fishery.
Is they a boat?
Or they can be a boat. They can be an individual. That's correct.
Oh, okay.
Under this scenario, they is right now anybody that's participating now.
Vessel owners,
the boat, the individual. And that's one of the things that we're asking them to find a criteria to quantify who is going to be eligible.
And so they that are eligible then will possess a dedicated access privilege at some time.
That's correct.
And will they be able to sell that privilege?
That's one of the things we've asked them to find out.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And we don't, personally, I don't think we think that, that's why it's always renewable. We can't, under the Constitution, give it to them because we can't allocate our resource to an individual. We know that.
Okay. Okay. Well, that helps lay a foundation for this. Thanks for your help.
Am I confused? You guys are
confused. I learned more than I
ever dreamed.
Yes. One of those things is jobby, and it's amazing how much you don't know.
Maybe you will. Thank you, Madam Chairman. One of the questions that I have, since allocations can't be made for a specific resource, is there any influence that this is going to have on the IFQs that are out there?
Senator Olson, would you pull your microphone to you, please, and speak into it, because we're having a hard time hearing you over here.
Okay. As you talked about, there's constitutional reasons why our resource is not allocated. And does this bill in any way influence the IFQs that are out there?
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. No, the halibut and the sable fish are the IFQ fisheries, and those are both managed by the federal side in agreement with the state.
Okay.
And so it's it's a different, what they call FMP. There's a fisheries management plan for halibut, black cod. This is a fisheries management plan for groundfish, which are defined as a certain number of species that I know that those of us in the fisheries understand what that is, but it's for pollock, codfish, and the flatfish.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Senator Hoffman, you had your hand.
Yes, I guess on the question of vessel owners, so individuals that have been investing in, I know it's highly, it's very costly to get into many of these fisheries, so individuals can just have a financial interest in a boat, a vessel, and can get, potentially with that history, can get their dedicated access privilege, their DAP, participate in this program. And what benefit would that
that's really part of the ability. If you look in the new section on the that begins on page 4, and it's actually they spell out the criteria, and it also goes down and then on page 5, section D, it says regulations adopted by the commission to establish a dedicated access privilege under this section must address exactly those things, Mr. Hoffman. Qualification dates, who is going to be the qualified interim use permit holder or the dedicated access privilege holder, and then number 2, number 3, and that really, a paragraph D, says that they must address those concerns while they develop the plan for implementation into that individual fishery. Each individual fishery may have different criteria, just like they do under fisheries management plans, and Southeast have different management plans than fisheries that are executed in the Norton Sound area.
So I guess we'll see what the board comes up with.
That's right. And more importantly, Mr. Hoffman, is we'll see what the industry comes up working with the board, because you have to remember that industry has to request the implementation and the development of this plan for their fishery. If they don't want it in their fishery, it won't be implemented. It won't be developed.
But there is language in here that says it has to be in the best interests of Alaska and Alaskans.
That's what it's for.
Right.
Yeah. It's the state water fisherman. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Stedman.
I think if we just maybe add on to what Senator Olson was alluding to a few minutes ago, if we back up in history a little bit, when we had the Russians and the Koreans up to a 3-mile limit and they got the boot and the Americans moved in and started capitalizing the industry and expanding it, and then there was the individual fishing quota system has come in and permit systems have come in. And would it be fair to say that this is kind of an evolution, looking not only at the benefits of this that have been put in place since the foreigners have been pushed out to the 200-mile limit, but also trying to improve upon the past restrictive entry systems?
I think that's a fair analysis. You know, the history of 200-mile limit, 1976, the establishment of the Magnuson Act, the management of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, Madam Chairman, used to be all what was called a TALF. It was called a Total Allowable Fishing for Foreign Fleets. And it used to be that all these fisheries fell under that allocation. And then there was the evolution of one that was called joint venture fishing, where U.S. harvesters caught the fish and sold it at sea with a transfer to a foreign factory ship. And then became the evolution of what was called the TAC, the Total Allowable Catch for American Fishing Fleets. came about, and then, of course, the evolution of the U.S.-owned foreign factory ship, and then the investment on the shore base for groundwater fisheries that started in the Bering Sea and in Kodiak. And now we have pressure and capitalization to where all the fish can be harvested by U.S. fleets. And not only that, but the competition between Alaska fleets and lower 48 fleets. This, Madam Chairman, I think is exactly as Mr. Stedman said, another evolution of an attempt to say we want the fish harvested inside 3 miles to go to Alaska-based communities, caught by Alaskan-based fishermen, managed by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And there's competition at every level now, and it's just an evolution of efficiency and an evolution of processing capacity and evolution of demand for our products.
Are there other questions at the table? Senator Hoffman?
I guess when you talk about that, we've Americanized the fishery beyond the 3 mile limit. Would it be fair to characterize this legislation as trying to Alaskanize the fishery inside the 3 mile limit?
I would characterize it as trying to protect the Alaskan participants. Let me try to do this in the most simplistic terms. There's that invisible barrier at 3 miles. The federal side have limited license participation. They have development of a quota system on the outside 3 miles. And there's a joint management regime that says inside 3 miles you can catch this much fish, outside 3 miles you can catch this much fish. But those that participate inside 3 miles cannot penetrate outward. But there's nothing that's in law, there's no limited access, or in other words, we have an open participation for those from the outside 3 miles that can come in and harvest all our fish first and then go outside and harvest their fish. But our participants that only fish on the inside cannot penetrate out. So that's in the most simplistic terms that we're trying to say those that have been historical participants inside can fish inside, those fish outside can fish outside. The fish swim back and forth, but we've had a regime that says so much can be caught inside, so much can be caught outside, but those outside cannot come in and catch our fish first, eliminating, shortening the seasons and the ability for our shore-based fishermen to earn a living doing it.
And that's the ultimate risk in all of this, is for that length of fishery to just get shorter and shorter.
And I believe, I don't know if I brought that, did I bring up the, Cheryl, we got the dates for the jig fisheries, the dates of the, do you have that one schedule? Time that the fisheries continue to get shorter and shorter and shorter every year.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Where typically they open in March. It used to be they'd open in March all the way through to October, and it's March to June. Now it's March to the middle of April. But just shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter.
So soon you could be less than a month, less than.
Some of the fisheries, Madam Chairman, are executed in 12 hours.
But that's
what we're trying to prevent from happening.
Catch them, you don't catch them.
I think it's time for a career change. Senator Wilkin.
Madam Chair, Senator Stevens, what is a mechanical jigging machine fishery and why are they excluded?
That's the controversial topic, Mr. Wilkin. A mechanical jig fishery machine is a machine that's set on the side of a smaller vessel that is operated using electrically or hydraulically that jigs, and then as soon as there's pressure on the jig, it automatically winds the fish up.
And small being? How
small vessel, 42 foot vessel.
Okay.
Maybe 26 foot vessel. It's a hook and line type of equipment.
Okay.
And you can have four or five or six of them on a small vessel. And a single individual or a crew of two can operate probably efficiently up to six or eight machines. And there are certain allocations by gear type. In other words, jig fisheries get allocated a certain amount, longline fisheries get allocated a certain amount, pot fisheries get allocated a certain amount, and trawl fisheries get allocated a certain amount. Okay. And as I said earlier, the jig fishery is typically the entry-level fishery because it's a small boat, not a lot of capital investment. And that's where people get into the fishery at a young age and start moving through. Some people have stayed in that fishery for many, many, many years, making a good living. And they have the most concern about the fact that they think that if we implement this program on them, they'll get too... That's a perfect example of the harder you work, the more fish you catch within that fishery. There's no question about it. And so we just decided to say, okay, if it's entry-level fishery, there's over 570 permits in the southwestern Gulf on that. We just said, there's not really an effort that wants to be in. There's a loud effort that says we don't want to be in. So we just said, okay, we'll just remove them from consideration on this. We did this last year with this piece of legislation, and then after that, they were satisfied. It's a different story this year.
Thank you.
That's why.
Okay.
Senator Wilson.
Just a quick question on these mechanical jig fishing boats. What are they primarily? What kind of fish are they primarily going for?
Pacific cod.
Pacific cod. Thank you.
And there's also some rockfish in there, but the main fishery is for the Pacific cod.
Senator Stepman.
The jigs look kind of similar to a downrigger that is commonly used.
A
downrigger that's commonly used to fish sport fish salmon.
Mm-hmm.
Just a modern way of getting away from a stick and a line or a fishing pole.
Senator Stevens, the next time we have a fishery spill here, we're going to have a glossary and a picture and a video.
A field trip,
yeah. There you go, yeah. Because some people at the table and in the audience actually understand what you're talking
about.
Some
of us that spend many years chasing
and we are
creatures
really happy.
With gills
we're
around
very happy
a large
for
part
you.
Of our life, we understand this, but I appreciate your attention, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the questions. As I said, this is a controversial piece of process legislation, but it allows the managers to develop a new regime of management that's being requested by certain participants in certain fisheries. And as I said before, I think it's contingent upon us to give them that ability to manage that they think they need, but also not make them implement it on those that don't want it. So that's what this does. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
We've been kind of suffering under the shock we had in learning what all the words in PERS and TERS meant. And that was a breeze compared to this. This gets very out of our league very quickly. So we appreciate your explanations and all the ones I'm sure we'll get from the other people. Are there any other questions for the sponsor? Because we do have some people online who've been contacted to participate in today's hearing. And I don't know if there's anyone in the room who wishes to testify, but from Kodiak, Donna Jones. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Donna, could you give us your testimony, please, and if you had to give your name and who you represent?
Yes, I will. To begin with, good morning, Senator Green and members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Donna Jones, and I'm here today to speak simply as a concerned citizen. I'm also here to speak against Senate Bill 113. This bill clearly goes against our state constitution in two ways. First of all, it bypasses our basic right to a legislative process by allowing the Board of Fish and the Entry Commission to make decisions that should be made on the legislative level. And second, it allows the allocation, or as it's also Fred Harvest Use Privilege, to our state fishery resources, many of which would be given out of state recipients. This allocation system of dedicated access privilege would seriously lessen the benefit of our fisheries resources to state residents, an entitlement that is guaranteed by our state constitution. Both of these issues are seriously impinging upon my rights as an Alaskan citizen. I recently made comment to the Senate Resource Committee that the true purpose of this bill was not to end the race for fish, but it was about the right, It was about the race to get the fish allocated. I believe this to be true. With the onset of the federal rationalization plan, and its plan to allocate our federal fishing quota to the boat owners, according to their history, our state is feeling great pressure to allocate our state waters fishery. This with the intent that it will somehow slow down the flood of fish to the processing plant. To allocate does in no way control the amount or the time that the deliveries are made to the dock. The flood of fish which fueled this bill and the federal rationalization is that of the trawl, pollock, and long-line cod fleet. The tools to limit the flood of fish to the dock are already being used within most other fisheries. Some examples include setting gear limits as in the pot cod fishery, setting time limits as in the barred-eyed crab fishery, which is limited to day fishing. And my preferred alternative is controlling the flood of fish to the dock is by setting weight and time limits as in the black rock fishery that only allows 5,000 pounds within any five-day period. Having the recent experience of being a plant and fleet manager to one of our local mid-sized canneries, I can clearly see the need to limit the trawl and longline fleet to avoid the flood of fish to the dock. This can very easily be done with our existing state regulatory system. Each year, quotas are set allowing our fishermen to fish while still protecting the overall biomass. Instead of sending out the fleet with no limits and allowing multiple races for fisheries, for fish deliveries, limits can be set by stating the amount of fish to be brought in within a time-specific period. A simple example would be one delivery per vessel for 7 days. The fishing vessel would still be allowed to fill up, thus maximizing the profit for the trip, and the seafood processing plants would be dealing with one load per vessel per week instead of a rush of 3 or 4 deliveries per week. This also addresses 2 other issues of concern, the first being the issue of safety, and the second is the slowing down of the total amount of pounds, allowing the processing plants the ability to focus on better quality and value-added products. The difference between federal and state interests is significant. The federal government caters to national interests and recipients, that being all of us within the United States. On the other hand, our state represents our residents and our best interests. This is another basis of my opposition to this bill. Our state has an obligation to do what is best for those of us who live here and have a vested interest. It is not my best interest for our state to allow the allocation of our fishery resources, let alone to outside interests. The Senate Bill 113 and the allocations that is intended, our state will suffer a great loss. The loss of jobs due to consolidation, the loss of jobs due to the possible formation of co-ops or associations, the loss of equal access to our entry-level fishermen, the loss of revenue to our communities, and the loss of control over our state fishery resources, all of which could ultimately cause the demise of many of our coastal communities and the families that are reliant on our fishery resources. I am against the privatization of our public resources. I believe that we must implement our state regulatory's existing tools to control the problems that we are currently facing. Considering the magnitude of the changes implied by the possible dedicated access privilege in Senate Bill 113, I as a resident would like to request that a social and economic impact study be done before passing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am, for joining us this morning. Any questions from the committee or from the bill's prime sponsors? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jones, are you a resident of the state of Alaska?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Other questions? The Senator Stedman.
Just a quick comment. I think dealing with the fishing industry, it's worked very well to move out of the legislative arena and down into the Board of Fish and other boards as far as regulation on the industry. It just goes to the comment by the...
You know, I don't have any problem with the Board of Fish or our Entry Commission being greatly involved within our fishing industry. Obviously, that's their job, but I think that the allocation of the fishing rights is something that nobody should have the right to do.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Jones. Other questions of Ms. Jones? Thank you for joining us this morning from Kodiak. Let's ask Glenn Carroll to please join us here at Finance. Glenn, good morning. Your testimony, please.
There was something broke in there. Is it unmuted? I think you said Glenn Carroll?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Finance Committee members. My name is Glenn Carroll. I have been in the fisheries for 40 years. I've lived in Alaska all my life. I have no other dependents or another income for that. I fished in the podcod fishery for about 10 years. And my comments will be in support of SB 113. I see very little future in the type of fishery that we're conducting right now. Under the Derby style, open to entry, Olympic competitive fishery, our seasons just get shorter and shorter, and the way in which we present our product to the world is really backward marketing. Please observe these statistics, and this was referred to earlier. In the year 2000, in the podcod fishery in Kodiak, the Kodiak podcod season was 10 months long. In the year 2005, it was 11 days. To those who want to continue with the status quo, I believe that this is like the bow of the Titanic is already under the water, and we can't just keep rearranging the deck chairs and asking the band to keep playing. In terms of marketing, I do a little bit of direct marketing. My wife and I, we send some cod to, fresh cod to Korea and back east and on a very small scale. But I've often said that the way we market our product, the cod, is analogous to the western states' cattlemen slaughtering three-quarters of their cow, their beef, on the 4th of July and expecting the market to absorb millions of pounds all at once. That's exactly what we do with the state of Alaska codfish resource. The season opens January 1, and in the next 6 to 8 weeks, we take three-quarters of the allowable catch in the Gulf of Alaska, and we cannot figure out why we get 30 cents for our fish when in Boston and Iceland they get a dollar. We flood the market, and all of the distributors and all the buyers across the country know immediately that all they just have to wait with open hands, because the processors in the state of Alaska, the docks are awash with fish for 6 weeks, and it's a bid downward. It's an auction in reverse. They just know that whoever's most desperate is going to sell their fish at a cheaper and cheaper price, and processors across the state bid each other down. Until we stop the race for fish, we will never treat our fish with the quality they deserve and which they use other places. Some criticisms of the DAP program I have listened to, they connect this as to the IFQ program. And as I listen carefully to the criticisms that are there, the criticisms are not about the IFQ program as much as they are in regard to the implementation of it, the actual how of some of these things were done. And I believe that there's nothing wrong with the concept of a quota share program. In the halibut industry, the price has tripled. Once you take away the race for fish, our halibut now are sold several months out of the year, and it's the only sane way to conduct business. Until we treat our fishery resources in the state of Alaska as something other than derbies, until we treat them as a business, we'll never really maximize the resource that is there. This bill begins the process that will lengthen and create more shore jobs in more communities throughout the state. It will increase the value of the fish and the quality of the jobs, I think, over the long time. One comment about the task force process has often been criticized, the Board of Fish process, in which three members worked with a task force of about 11 people, as I recall, from around the Gulf of Alaska. Several people have commented that this bill did not flow out of a real public process. I participated in that work committee or that task force that the Board of Fish created. It was over a year and a half. It was was an exceedingly public process, and the general tone that prevailed throughout it all, Board Chairman Ed Dershowitz at the time, simply just created the general tone. We want good ideas. If you have good ideas, now is the time to put them on the table. And there was very lively discussion and debate and consideration. It was a brainstorming session, in my opinion, and it was represented from people from Chignik, Sandpoint, Kodiak, Homer, Cordova, and Anchorage, and it was a very public process. Those who say it was not, I believe, simply have a different agenda. I believe in the DAP program, and I believe in the Board of Fish, that the open process by which they function can create a fishery that will avoid the criticisms and the problems that the IFQ program did have. Thank you.
Thanks, Glenn, for your testimony. Are there questions or comments of Mr. Carroll? Hey, thank you, sir, for joining us this morning and helping us out. Let's ask Julie Bonnie to join us. Julie, good morning. Your testimony, please.
Yes, members of the Senate Finance, I'm going to pick this up and see if it does better. Good morning. My name is Julie Bonney, and I represent the members of Alaska Groundfish Data Bank, both shore-based trawl catcher vessels and shore-based processors. I am a 22-year resident of Alaska. My members support Senate Bill 113, which allows the Board of Fish and CFEC to explore fishery restructuring for groundfish fisheries inside 3 miles using a dedicated access privilege. We appreciate the Memorandum of Understanding that lays out the public process and the fiscal note that will allow hearings to be held in affected communities. Senate Bill 113 is process legislation. My members will engage in this process and will work diligently to develop fair and equitable plans in conjunction with the Board of Fish and CFEC. While entering the unknown with your entire livelihood at stake is a risky business, fishery restructuring needs to happen in the Gulf groundfish fisheries. The present management structure focuses on catching the most amount of fish instead of extracting the most value for every fish that is caught. Industry needs to be able to respond to global markets. Presently, we are under assault from farm fish around the world. With tilapia has increased by 400% in production over the last few years, which competes directly with whitefish, both pollock and cod, harvested in Alaska. Presently, farmed peacod is being explored and it continues to grow in production. We must be given the tools to be competitive in the global market. A couple of other examples of how the system is broke is in the pollock fishery in the Kodiak area. We had a 12-hour fishery this year in 2005, and the fleet took 9 million pounds in 12 hours that had to be processed. This was 200% of the allowable catch for that fishery. Presently, there's the Prince William Sound State Pollock Fishery, which is the only open access trawl fishery on the Pacific Coast. For this fishery this year, we had 12 vessels that registered to participate. The whole capacity of those 12 vessels was twice the allowable catch. The other issue that needs to be highlighted here is that in the federal fishery structure that's moving forward with rationalization, it became apparent through the Board of Fish Rationalization Task Force that even though fishers thought they were participating in a federal fishery, if they were fishing inside three, they were actually under state jurisdiction. And if they were fishing outside three, they were under federal jurisdiction. This DAP concept allows those that were fishing inside three under a federal program with all the appropriate observer coverage, regulations, to be treated somewhat similar to those in the, that were fishing outside. So hopefully when we're all done with the process, the two pieces can be melded and those federal participants can be treated equally. We also believe that it's important that the process consider historical investments, both by shoreside processors, catcher vessels, and consider impacts to fishery restructuring on fishery-dependent communities. The other thing that I wanted to highlight for you is that we spent a lot of time with the Attorney General, Representative John Gold. And one of the biggest hurdles for developing a dedicated access privilege is going to be dealing with the concept of the least impingement clause of the Constitution. This means that a DAP is not going to be an IFQ. It's going to have to be designed in such a way that it's more of a leasing privilege where the state of Alaska will always have ownership on the resource. That there will have to be a discussion on the duration of the fishing privilege, whether a portion of the history would revert back to the state so that it can be reallocated to second generation fishers. There also will be discussion about allocation in terms of whether it goes to vessel owners, skipper, crew. All those pieces will be developed in the Board of Fish process where everyone within the public is going to have an opportunity to participate. I also wanted to highlight that the Department of Fish and Game did a analysis of the fishers that participate in 0 to 3 miles. And this is truly an Alaskan fishery. When you look at just the Kodiak District, when you combine both the ownership of the vessel and the skippers, for the Kodiak longline fishery, 96% was harvested by Alaska vessel owners and hired skippers. In the Kodiak pod fisheries, it was 95%. For Kodiak trawl fisheries, it's 47%. So to say that this resource is going to be allocated to folks outside of the state of Alaska is not true. My final comment is I hope that you pass out Senate Bill 113 today. Ben Stevens has mentioned, this is process legislation, and then the process will begin with both CFAC, the Board of Fish, and industry stakeholders. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julie. Any questions for Julie? Thank you. Lance Nelson with the Department of Law.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm the Assistant Attorney General assigned to represent the Board of Fish, and I've been consulting on SB 113 and in its drafting before it was introduced with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. And I took over sort of midstream for Assistant Attorney General John Goltz, who left our department in January. But I've had a chance to review the bill and discuss it with sponsors, staff, and others. And the Department of Law believes it's presents a process that would enable the development of a program that would be, we think, would be the most likely to pass constitutional muster. We know that there's always a risk that our Supreme Court could find some flaw with whatever program we come up with, but we think the process that's established in SB 113 will be the probably the best possible way to refine and develop and refine a program that is the most likely to pass constitutional muster. We had a general, an informal Attorney General opinion issued in 1995 that opined that a program like this would likely pass constitutional muster, and that's been the position of our department. We haven't taken any contrary position since then, so I think we've been consistent with the idea that a program could be developed, and like the dedicated access privilege program contemplated by this bill, chance at surviving any constitutional challenge. And I'm available for other questions if there are any.
Are there any questions for the Assistant AG, Board of Fish? Thank you very much, Lance. And Ed Dershowitz? Ed Dershowitz, are you online?
Yes, Madam Chair, can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. If you'd give your name and who you represent, please.
Thank you. My name is Ed Dershowitz. I'm Vice Chairman of the Alaska Board of Fisheries. And I'll try to not go over ground I already covered, but to give a brief history of this process and make a few comments about the legislation. As Senator Stevens mentioned, that our guest, the Alaska Groundfish Rationalization Committee that I chaired, had 9 days of public meetings over a 1.5 year period. And in addition, the Board of Fish had its regularly scheduled meetings, spent some time in at least 3 different meetings taking public input and discussing this process. As Julie Bonney has testified to, one of the things we found early on in the committee process was that the participants in both the parallel fisheries in state waters and the state water cod fishery in Alaska state waters are predominantly Alaska residents. So it was clear that if a way could be found to allocate at least partially based on history of participants, that could be a good thing for Alaskans in reaction to a federally rationalized fishery outside 3 miles. We also realized that the current board authority does not allow that, and that our exploration of possible ways to address that within our current authority would not work. The problem with our current authority is it works well for many of the things that the Alaska Board of Fisheries is required and asked to do, but when it comes to trying to slow a race for fish or protect participants in state waters in relation to changes in federal fisheries in adjacent waters, the only tools we have, primary method and means to address a race for fish, we actually create more economic inefficiency as we're trying to slow the race. And even to that extent, it doesn't always work. For example, during this process, while we've been working on reactions to federal Gulf rationalization, the race for fish that you've been hearing about from different testifiers in Arctic and Cod has gotten much worse over this last 2 years. And we have many of our primary method and means restrictions already placed on the state water cod fishery. And in the case of POTS, it's not currently slowing the fishery. We would, under a rationalized federal side, we would have to go to such extreme measures that it would become almost ridiculous economic inefficiency to try to do that. So out of this process came our support for this legislation. I'll touch on the MOU and the fiscal note that's attached to the bill. The MOU is jointly developed by FEC and the Board of Fish to flesh out the public process that would take place after this legislation passed in order to go out and gather public input, the desires and needs of the fisheries involved. And we feel it's a fairly new joint public process of the CFEC and the board that would be very beneficial in developing any potential actions that would come out of the legislation. The fiscal note for $46,500 is to specifically address that initial process of public hearings in the communities most affected by any future developed dedicated access privileges. The overall benefits that we see potentially from use of this process legislation are directly intended to benefit communities and Alaskan resident participants to the extent possible. And we just see a much more comprehensive potential solution to some of these races for fish than we could come up with our current authorities or even with CFPC's current limited energy authority. And I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. Just hold on for a sec. Do any of the members have any questions about the letter of intent and the attached memorandum of understanding? Okay, because it is part of the motion that's going to occur. But we're going to lay this aside for the day and go back and review the fiscal notes and see if there's any corrections or adjustments that need to be made to that. And then we'll probably bring this back tomorrow and continue work on it then. And and we'll, in the meantime, kind of review what accounts and how that should be set up. And with that, Senate Bill 113 is laid aside till tomorrow, or the next, another, a future meeting. And in the fisheries line as well, we have Senate Bill 124. And who's welcome. Thank you, Ed, and all others who testified today on 113, and for the people who came to hear on that. Senate Bill 124, fisheries business license / bond.
Yep. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Chuck Harlemert. I'm with the Alaska Department of Water. I'm very pleased to present Senate Bill 124. The objectives of this bill are, there's two main goals. One is to increase the processor's accountability for the payment of obligations that support the industry. And the second is to improve the protections available to employees and fishermen who either work for or sell to processors. In section one of the bill, we modify current law, which only requires that the processor be current on their taxes under Title 43 in order to obtain a license, to also require them to be current in their payment of ESC, OSHA fines, the seafood marketing assessment that funds ASME, and local fish taxes. Okay. Section 2 of the bill is a...
Just a minute, for all the members, if you haven't realized, you have a kind of a report that delineates, I think, everything you're talking about. Does it
yes,
not?
Yes, that's a very detailed section.
CS Senate Bill number 24 there on the top. And then there's also an overview that right. they've presented that will help you walk your way through what this attempts to do. Go ahead, Chuck.
Am I too detailed for you? Or?
No, you're doing
great.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Section 2 of the bill deals with an anomaly that some processors face under current law. We require our processors to secure the estimated tax. They don't have to pay the tax up front. They instead can delay payment of the tax until March 31 of the following calendar year. But in exchange for that deferral, they have to provide security for that tax. And if the processor needs to be licensed from January 1 through March 31 period, they end up in a position of having to provide security for 2 years worth of taxes.
Okay.
And for that 3-year period, that's quite a bind. And so this law allows them to use the same security for 2 periods during that bridge period. Section 3 of the bill is the most complicated section of the bill, and it changes our bonding requirements and the conditions for employees and fishermen to gain satisfaction from the bond in an effort to make the bond levels more responsive to the risks appropriate for particular processors. And it does this in a couple of ways. One, it it eases the rules that increase bail amounts based upon processors fired to pay fishermen or employees or OSC. So the bond level can go up easier. The initial bond levels are unchanged.
Chuck, I'm having a very difficult time understanding you. You're going to have to talk louder.
Okay, I'm sorry. Essentially,
this is sort of the heart of what we're about, right, in it, Section 3?
That is
the difficult part.
Section 1 and Section 2 are the sections of the
OS. Thank you. Yeah.
And what this does is it makes the bond levels more responsive to processors' behavior.
Okay.
And so a processor who fails to pay employees or fishermen is more likely under this bill to have their bond level go up. And they will not be able to use
Okay, and I understand that your bond level may go up, but at what point does non-payment of any of these obligations become a huge red flag and the deal's off? Or there's penalty, or there's prosecution, or what happens?
Okay, Madam Chairman, if the taxpayer is delinquent of the if the processor is delinquent on their taxes on Title 43, ESC, OSHA fines, or the seafood marketing assessment, then they cannot get their license to begin with. Okay, so that's typically going to occur at the point where they get their license. We find that to be a very effective tool for getting receiving payment of fisheries business tax.
Okay.
And we expect that won't have a large influence, except that folks will be more likely to pay these taxes.
Okay. And then and on the other hand, if someone persists in non-payment, that goes into another category of penalty, not just withholding a license. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if I understand your question. Are you referring, there are two major parts of the bill. One is the requirements for licensure,
mm-hmm.
and the other is bonding. And okay. I need to talk about them separately, or I'll get mixed up.
If you're going to get mixed up, I can't imagine what happens to us.
Yeah.
So take it very slowly then. Senator Stedman, you have some insight here.
Well, I don't think I have insight, but I'm just kind of curious. Just looking through the fiscal notes, it mentioned that there might be some revenue generated from collection of some fishery business tax, or excuse me, seafood marketing tax, or assessments. I wonder if you could elaborate on that. Apparently, there must be a feeling that some of them are underpaid. And then the other point is, if a processor gets in trouble through lack of payment, and the state steps in and requires an increase in bonding and requires a cash bond, is that going to put the processor in a position of being knocked out of the market and put them in a position of inability to respond? Because I would assume if they're not paying their fisheries business tax and their seafood marketing assessment, or possibly paying their fishermen, it's because they have a cash flow problem.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, on your first question, we estimate we will have better luck collecting the seafood marketing assessment. As it stands now, it's not a required payment to get your license, and
okay.
many are relatively few, I guess, taxpayers pay the fisheries business tax because they have to be licensed, but don't pay their ASME. And this will change that, and we expect to see an incremental amount of additional revenue. On the bonding side, once again, if the failure to pay the fisheries business tax or any of the levies except ESC won't affect your bond. What affects your bond is whether you've paid your fishermen, your employees, and your unemployment security contribution. Okay, and those are an existing law. That is unchanged. What is changed is under current law, if you don't pay fishermen or employees and they sue and obtain a judgment against you, you can elect to pay that judgment out of your existing assets instead of from the bond and avoid the consequences under law of having your bond increased. Current law would still increase your bond level from 10,000 to 50 or 100 if the bond was used to satisfy a judgment and was insufficient. But processors under current law can get around that by simply paying it directly out of their pocket or their checkbook instead of letting it come out of the bond. This law changes that to where the mere existence of a judgment in excess of 10,000 will trigger the increase in the bond level from 10,000 to 50,000.
Pat, is it testimony you're going to give have anything to do with what we're talking about?
It does.
Okay, why don't you come on up and maybe we can have the, rather than do these questions twice, we can get it taken care of.
For the record, my name is Pat Shire. I'm here as the Acting Deputy Director for the Employment Security Division, Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and as the Chief of Unemployment Security Tax. We're the collectors for the Department of Labor.
I don't wear wallets.
Do any of the questions we've attempted to ask today, albeit awkwardly, would they better be come under the purview of what your department does versus what revenue has in mind with the issuance?
Oh, I think Chuck is doing a great job. but as far as the bond is concerned, there is an opportunity for the Department of Labor to move against the bond more quickly than we have in the past. And the idea is that the more quickly we can move, the more quickly we can solve some of these problems before the fish, cash, and processor are all three gone out of state somewhere.
Okay. And I think that's probably what I was trying to ask, but didn't know how to ask it, so I appreciate the information. So, okay, go ahead, Chuck. Carry us through this.
To finish responding to Senator Sedman's question, which is also part of my presentation, under current law, any processor who can demonstrate the existence of real property in the state equal to their required bond level is essentially excused from having a bond. Which works fine if there's no trouble, but it's very problematic to foreclose against that real property to satisfy a judgment. This bill places a restriction on the use of real property, that if you have a record of non-payment of judgments against you for failure to pay fishermen, employees, or ESC, you have to use real property in lieu of bond. You have to put up a cash bond, which we obviously can get to easier and more efficiently. And those are really the primary bond changes. It makes it more responsive to risks and easier to get to.
Okay, and Pat, did you have a question, Senator Stedman?
Well, I'm still having a conceptual challenge here, I guess.
Well, so we have Pat go ahead.
Well, just differentiating between a shoreside processor that may get in a liquidity bind due to market conditions or mismanagement or what have you is one scenario. And then the other scenario, I think, is maybe what you're driving at is the smaller or maybe even a large processor that happens to be floating that just in the state today and gone tomorrow. More or less than a fixed shoreside plant that's been, you know, located and established in a community for maybe generations or?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, that is my understanding of the roots of the real estate or real property exception to the bond requirement that typically established longtime corporate citizens of Alaska tend to have real property, and they were allowed to use that real property in lieu of a bond, whereas floating processors or itinerant processors, depending on how you want to look at them, didn't have the same connection to the state, and we got a cash bond from them to protect fishermen and employees. And those rules still apply. There's no change in that basic bonding requirement on either the bonding levels or the right to use real property in lieu of cash. The only changes in the bill are where you have failed to pay a fisherman or employee or the Department of Labor, the consequences are more immediate and more realistic, perhaps is a better term.
Thank you.
Thank you. Was there another hand up? Oh, Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in regard to that, if I'm a small fisher person and I happen to buy a few fish from somebody else, so I would fall under the bonding requirement? And so I'd have to put up a bond. But could I use my house to secure that bond as long as I stayed current with these taxes that are and wages that are due? Or do I have to put up a cash bond that's now restricted?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, you're right. If you buy fish in the state, you're a fish buyer, you have to put the bond unless you have real property in the state. And then you can put that up in lieu of a cash bond.
So if I had equity in my house, I could put
Absolutely.
Up a portion of that equity?
Absolutely.
So I wouldn't have to have cash in the bank?
That's right.
Okay. And so this only changes that to the extent that if I fall behind in ESC or wages paid, then I can't use my house?
If you have, that's right. Once you have a judgment for wages not paid to employees or payments to fishermen that you didn't make, or you've had your hearings and okay. failed to pay your ESC, you mm-hmm. do get due process there, then you would be no longer allowed or for a period of a few years not allowed to use real property.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Are there other questions? Pat, I thought you'd like to add to the discussion here today.
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development supports this bill for two primary reasons. The fact that it's a condition of obtaining a license helps us clear the slate for the coming year so that we don't end up in a situation where somebody who's been a miscreant for a number of years or been unable to pay enters into an agreement, has fish on the dock, and then forgets to pay people for a few weeks and it becomes an issue. We'd like to prevent that going into the season. I should point out that these are folks that have had ample opportunity to deal with this. We have things like deferred payment contracts and negotiated settlements and things of that nature that are available to employers. The Department of Labor realizes that employers provide jobs, and that's very important. So we're not seeking to hobble the folks that want to do the right thing or that, as Senator Wilkin mentioned, may fall on hard times one particular year. It also gives an incentive to deal with us, perhaps, if they have not returned our phone calls, et cetera, in order to make arrangements to pay these arrearages for OSHA fines, wage claims, or UI taxes, that they can call us, we can set up that deferred payment contract and secure that before we have to go to the next step, which in Section 3 talks about compressing the time available for us to actually go after the bond. And the bond is important because that sometimes is the only thing that's left after I mentioned the fish are gone, the cash is gone, the employer is gone. And it quickly raises a need for the higher bonding amount. All these processes that we're talking about have included in them ample administrative review established over time. It's equitable. And we would recommend that you move this bill on.
Thank you. Are there questions for Pat? Thank you very much for bringing the information forward to us. And okay. And I have no objection to this leaving committee. If I have no hesitancy on the parts of the member, I'd accept a motion to move it on to rules.
Madam Chair, I move to report Senate Bill 124. From committee with individual recommendations and attach fiscal notes.
The objection? Senate Bill 124, Fisheries Business License and Bond, moves from committee with individual recommendations and company fiscal notes. No, I'm very sorry. We'll get you first thing tomorrow, okay? Be here bright and early, okay? And at 12:30 today, conference committee for the operating budget, and tomorrow at 9 a.m., of continuation or the beginning of SB 153 on international airport revenue bonds, and then HB 97, HB 19, and HB 15. And if you'll check the schedule after 4 p.m., if we have any changes to that, we will have them noted as well. With that, we are adjourned.